From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the show are Cindy Sain, VOA diplomatic correspondent, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive editor. Welcome back, Cindy and Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, here are the issues. President Biden laid out his rationale and timeline for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. He has decided to withdraw by September 11, 2021, 20 years to the day after al-Qaeda's attacks on the U.S. triggered America's longest war, but several months after a May 1st deadline negotiated by the Trump administration. In addition, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken made an unannounced visit on Thursday to Kabul. The U.S. and NATO allies are concerned about the Russian military buildup along Ukraine's border and in occupied Crimea. Also, President Biden reassured Republicans who are skeptical of his infrastructure plan that he's willing to negotiate with them. However, House Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is considering the possibility of Democrats having to go it alone, as they did on the passage of the COVID relief package. The defense in the Derek Chauvin trial made a dramatic plea to the judge to acquit his client without sending his case to the jury. The judge denied the motion, and not far away from where the trial is taking place, nightly protests have continued in a Minneapolis suburb after a police officer fatally shot a 20-year-old African-American man during a traffic stop. We'll also look at the latest setbacks in COVID-19 vaccines, as federal health officials in the U.S. recommended an immediate pause on the use of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine after reports of potentially dangerous blood clots. We'll look at what this means in the global fight against COVID-19 and here in the U.S., where President Biden is pushing to ensure all Americans are eligible for vaccination by May 1st. Well, let's get started with the issues. Cindy, I'll start with you. President Biden announced on television that he has decided to withdraw U.S. troops from Afghanistan by September 11th of this year. And then we have the U.S. Secretary of State Blinken making a surprise visit to Kabul on Thursday. So what is your take on this?
Yes, well, Kim, it's been a dramatic week for foreign policy here in the U.S. with President Biden going to the Roosevelt Room in the White House, the same room where then President George Bush had announced that he was sending American troops to Afghanistan 20 years ago. And President Biden said it's time to end America's longest war, basically saying that no amount of American troops, whether it's 100,000 or 2,500 as now, are going to be able to pull the society together and to stop these targeted attacks by the Taliban and al-Qaeda terrorist groups, and that the U.S. will continue to support Afghanistan financially with humanitarian aid and diplomatically, but that it's time for American troops to come home, and it's time for the U.S. to focus on the threats of today, not the threats of 20 years ago. And as you said, Secretary Blinken has made a surprise visit to Afghanistan to reassure Afghan leaders, President Ghani, that although American troops are all leaving, the U.S. is not deserting Afghanistan. Blinken said, we want to preserve the gains made over the last 20 years in building a civil society and in protecting the rights of women in Afghanistan, which, of course, is a huge concern.
Yes. And also, Steve, there is concern over the threat by the Taliban to resume hostilities against foreign troops if they are not removed by May 1st. Is this a legitimate concern?
I think it's a legitimate concern. President Donald Trump had set the May 1st, 2021 deadline of getting out of Afghanistan, and the Taliban agreed to that. That was an agreement. And what I found interesting in President Biden's announcement yesterday is that while he admitted it may not have been how he might have planned it, if he were president, he will live up to the commitment made by the previous American president to live up to the agreement of withdrawal, not necessarily by May 1st, but by September 11th. There are talks going on as far as with the Taliban and with the Afghan government. And yes, these threats should be taken seriously, as should the president's determination to pull the remaining couple of thousand, 2,500 American troops out by September 11th. What is also important to note here is that NATO is also going to be leaving with the United States. The British are now starting to decide how to pull their troops out of Afghanistan. Other troops from other NATO nations will be pulling out as well. So I think the probably the biggest announcement and the biggest point of trying to end this 20-year war in and around Afghanistan.
And also, what are some risks involved in pulling out, Cindy?
A lot of analysts say that the big fear is that the Taliban will once again regain control of the country and that the Afghan government, which has been supported by the United States, will fall. And that, of course, could have all kinds of implications for human rights, for women's rights. And interestingly, Secretary Blinken met with some members of Afghan civil society, and reporters there on the ground asked one woman member of parliament if how she felt about the U.S. leaving and the future of the country, and she said she is pessimistic. So Afghans are very worried now about what will happen when American troops are no longer there.
And also just one more question on this subject. Steve, the U.S. and coalition forces were able to drive the Taliban from power, as you pointed out, and a new Afghan government was created. So how successful has the new government been so far?
The success is in fits and starts. And there have been very small successes and very large setbacks. The strength of the Afghan government is only as strong as its members and its resolve. As Cindy pointed out, there is concern that the Taliban can be resurgent and force out the existing government and do what it did 20 plus years ago in ruling Afghanistan. These are the concerns that are overriding as far as the pullout of American and NATO troops are concerned. But to the same extent, it has been this overriding concern for the last 20 years.
Well, we will continue to follow this story. And as Cindy pointed out, Biden is now looking ahead to greater geopolitical challenges. He highlighted the economic competition with China, for one, and also looking at actions by Russia targeting the U.S. And of course, Russia is another big concern that we're watching. Cindy, Russia's defense minister has claimed that the country's military buildup near the Ukraine is a response to what he describes as threats from the U.S. and NATO allies building up their forces near Russia's borders. What is the situation there?
Well, I think that's what a lot of Western officials are trying to figure out. And the fact is that it is the largest Russian military buildup along its borders with Ukraine and the Crimean Peninsula since Russia's 2014 illegal annexation of the Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. So NATO officials, U.S. leaders, including President Biden, say they are very concerned by this. It is not clear what Russians' intentions are. Analysts that I have spoken to, I asked, do you think that Russia is getting ready to invade Ukraine? And they said they don't know what sense it would make for Russia militarily, what gains it could make with that, but that it's more perhaps of a political movement to show that leaders in Ukraine, we are strong, you know, we can threaten you. And we had Secretary Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin in Brussels meeting with NATO officials, and all of the NATO officials were united in saying that Russia needs to de-escalate and needs to stop its provocations.
President Biden expressed his concern in a phone call this week with Russia's President Putin. Is it too early to tell what kind of a relationship these two presidents have at this time?
It's probably a little too early to tell what kind of relationship they have at the point of where they are momentarily. They are President of the United States and the President of the Russian Federation. But these two have known each other for quite a long time. And I don't necessarily think there's a unfamiliarity kind of issue between the two of them. I think both leaders are trying to figure out how best to work with what the realities are, as well as President Biden trying to do a kind of 180 with the U.S. relationship with Russia, as opposed to how President Trump treated President Putin and Russia, which is much more of a hands-off type of thing. Biden really wants to make sure President Putin knows that the United States is here and the United States is going to push back on what it thinks is undemocratic and anti-democracy type of movements by Russia.
And Cindy, just your take on Russia's relationship with the U.S. right now.
Yes, it was interesting that President Biden, amid these tensions over Ukraine, picked up the phone to call Putin and apparently warned him starkly, but at the same time offered him a summit in the coming months in a third country, which Russia has said it will depend on U.S. behavior as to whether the two will meet. But the U.S. is stressing, and Secretary Blinken and others, that despite all these tensions and disagreements, the U.S. wants to have a predictable relationship with Russia. And experts that I've talked to say this is good. It's reminiscent of Cold War diplomacy, where tensions can be very high, but when you have the leaders sitting down and talking out issues, it tends to be a less threatening and a less dangerous climate.
Following up on that, is it does seem like we are returning to a pre-2016 type of presidential relationship building with adversaries as well as allies at the very top of the diplomatic ring.
Okay, well, we will continue to watch and see how the relationship continues to develop. Last week, we looked at President Biden's infrastructure plan and the challenges that go along with it. Well, this week it's still right up there as an issue. Cindy, Mississippi Republican Senator Roger Wicker on ABC's This Week show described the plan as, quote, "This is a massive social welfare spending program combined with a massive tax increase on small business job creators. I can't think of a worse thing to do," unquote. Is this infrastructure plan going to be an uphill battle for Biden?
Well, it has not won over a single Republican vote in Congress so far, although the plan, according to some polls, is very popular among American voters, with one poll showing 2 in 3 Americans support it. And Republicans are calling the plan a wish list for the far left, and are saying, you know, it needs to be greatly reduced and it needs to focus on more traditional infrastructure elements such as roads and bridges. Whereas Democrats, including Senator Bernie Sanders, who's head of the Budget Committee, and Vice President Kamala Harris, are saying we also need to focus on human infrastructure. And Biden's proposal would include a lot of money for care for children and for older and disabled Americans. And Vice President Kamala Harris says we need to give Americans the tools to go to work. And during COVID, people are having to take care of their children, and some people are having to take care of elderly parents. We need to help families in this regard.
Also, Steve, what would be the repercussions if the Democrats decided to push it through without Republican support, or if a Democrat voted no?
I'm doubtful that there will be a vote if the Democrats cannot count on all 50 members of the Senate, all Democrats in the Senate, to vote for it. So before it even comes to a vote, the Democrats are going to make sure that they've got at least all of their 50 votes in their pocket. If it gets passed along a party line, the fallout will be just more political back and forth, more questions about whether or not President Biden was sincere in his campaign promises, as well as his rhetoric after becoming president of seeking bipartisanship and seeking Republicans to come along and vote on his measures. The Republicans, however, see this as an opportunity to try and unite against the Democrats and put up a united front for the 2022 elections, in which the Republicans see opportunities to gain seats in both the House of Representatives and in the Senate Usually in the first term of a president, the opposite party gains seats. Now we have United Democratic Party control in the White House and in both chambers of the Congress. So Republicans are banking on trying to oppose Biden as a way to come out of the 2022 elections in a better position.
Yes, and we will continue to follow developments as issues of the plan continue to be discussed. Let's take a short break, and when we return, we'll look at the latest developments in the Derek Chauvin trial and another case in Minnesota that involves a police officer shooting an unarmed black man. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Cindy Sain, VOA diplomatic correspondent, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive editor. Well, Steve, in the Derek Chauvin trial, we have defense attorney Eric Nelson initially requesting an acquittal from the judge for Derek Chauvin. The judge denied the motion. Nelson argued a combination of Floyd's underlying heart disease, adrenaline, and the fentanyl and methamphetamine he had ingested prior to the arrest amounted to a fatal combination causing his death. How confident, from your perspective and what you've been covering, do you think the defense is?
The defense, in making its request, is a typical defense motion tactic. The defense does not have to prove anything. It is all on the prosecution to prove the case. And in many cases, the defense will ask the judge to dismiss the case because the prosecution hasn't convinced beyond a reasonable doubt its job. So that it was much more procedure than it was anything that the defense did to say, okay, we're all done and wrapped up here. So right now the defense has put on several witnesses, several both police witnesses and several health officials to try and rebut and make the case and sow some doubt into whether or not George Floyd's death was caused by his detention by Officer Chauvin, who had him down on his stomach with his knee in it, on his neck. It is the defense's job to try and put some doubt into the jury's mind as to whether or not their client, Officer Chauvin, caused the death of George Floyd. So they're bringing in all kinds of questions about Mr. Floyd's drug use, Mr. Floyd's physical health, and facts that he had been treated previously for various different ailments. The defense is doing its job to try and poke holes in the prosecution's case and try to get the 12 jurors to wonder whether or not the death of George Floyd was caused by the officer or whether he had preconditions that would create his death in other ways. Right now, the trial is moving into the defense's time now to put on witnesses and ask questions. We will see the direction of their case shortly. The case should go to the jurors and they will start deliberating on the case.
Another case not too far from where the trial of Chauvin is taking place involving former Minnesota police officer Kim Potter, who was charged with second-degree manslaughter in the death of Dante Wright, a 20-year-old African-American man. Cindy, just in your coverage of these types of trials, given the protests and violence that have been taking place this week, did this charge come quickly?
Protesters there on the ground in Minnesota are very angry and very frustrated, and they think that the charge of second-degree manslaughter, I believe, does not go far enough. They say that Mr. Wright, that this young man was shot at a traffic stop, and it's just after so many other cases of what many would say are just excessive violence and snap judgment, use of weapons by police officers, against minority members of the community. And so many protesters are saying this charge does not go far enough.
Well, both Potter and Brooklyn Center Police Chief Tim Gannon resigned. In body camera footage, Ms. Potter appears to mistakenly withdraw her pistol when trying to pull out her taser. And with tensions already high, as you mentioned, amid the trial of Derek Chauvin, many are wondering if it was truly a tragic mistake.
It does appear to be a tragic mistake because of the either mistaken or accidental nature of what it seems to be. The charges of second-degree involuntary manslaughter do seem to be appropriate. That said, the prosecutor can add charges as the investigation moves forward. As you mentioned, the officer involved and the police chief of the town have resigned. I don't necessarily think that is going to satisfy many in the Minneapolis area, but it is the first step, and additional charges could be filed in the case.
Well, U.S. lawmakers are presently working with both civil rights activists, law enforcement authorities, and the law enforcement community about what would be most effective moving forward in terms of police reform legislation, and we will continue to follow those developments. And I wanted to get in some last comments on our topic of the COVID vaccines. The CDC and FDA have recommended an immediate pause in the use of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine after reports of potentially dangerous blood clots. Cindy, how will this affect Biden's goal of ensuring all Americans are eligible to be vaccinated by May 1st?
Well, it might delay it slightly, although the U.S. is in a very good position with also having the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine better position than a lot of other countries are. But the move has been criticized by all sides, with some saying that the risk is so low that this move to pause the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is creating a lot of uncertainty and maybe giving arguments to those who have been hesitant to take the vaccine at all, saying, you know, it's too risky and there hasn't been enough time to see if there are negative health impacts. But Dr. Fauci and other leading U.S. health officials say, actually, this pause shows exactly how high our standards are, just to make sure to get to the bottom of this and to make sure that there aren't any health or safety dangers.
And one of the U.S. president's other goals is for Americans to have a normal 4th of July celebration. However, even with vaccines, there's still a pandemic going on and then a recovery from the pandemic. So your thoughts on this, Steve?
The Johnson & Johnson vaccine represents about 5% of the vaccines being given in the United States. One of the important advantages of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is it is a single shot and it doesn't have to be kept at incredibly low temperatures. So it is important as far as vaccinating, I think, the rest of the world. As far as the United States is concerned, officials say that there is enough vaccine of the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine to be able to cover most Americans. So there's not a concern that there's going to be a lot of problems in getting vaccines out to Americans. The big concern is vaccine hesitancy, and the news about Johnson & Johnson has put some hesitancy into some people's heads. I also wonder if they did not make this announcement or made the announcement and continued to make the Johnson & Johnson vaccine available, whether vaccine hesitancy would go even further higher because the government would have either admitted that there's a problem and continued to administer the vaccine, or not admitted that a problem existed, and the news eventually would leak out at some later point, creating more questions about whether or not the vaccines are safe to use. So in the long run, as far as the United States is concerned, I think that there shouldn't be much of a problem in getting vaccines out to as many Americans who want it. But for the rest of the world, the Johnson & Johnson single shot and the AstraZeneca shot, which also has rare blood clot issues attached to it, for the rest of the world getting vaccinated, that is going to be much more of a problem than here in the United States.
And we're going to wrap up on that note. That's all the time we have. I want to thank our panelists, Cindy Sain, VOA diplomatic correspondent, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive editor. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.